Greetings, urban farmers, gardeners, and healthy food visionaries. Farmer Greg here, and welcome to the 853rd episode of the Urban Farm Podcast, where every day we work together to educate and inspire you to become part of your food revolution. Today on our podcast, we have someone who specializes in plant innovation. We're talking with returning guest Diane Blazek about how new plants get to your garden. Diane is the Executive Director of All America Selections and National Garden Bureau. She has been deeply and happily immersed in gardening from a very early age. From growing up on a small family farm in Missouri to her suburban lot in the Chicagoland area, she is passionate about everything green. Hello, Diane. We got to meet you in podcast 763 back in August of 2023. Welcome back to the show. Are you ready to rock?
I am very ready to rock. Very thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. You bet. So today we're going to be talking about segments of horticulture, and I'm just going to let you jump in and start because I'm not quite clear where we're going.
Well, that's why I wanted to discuss this topic, because I think it's really cool for the average home gardener to understand where their plants come from. And there's usually about six, maybe, different hands that a plant will go through before it lands in your backyard. So one of the ones that I think we would like to talk about a lot today is like the breeding of new plants, but that's where everything starts. Think of plant breeding as the originating manufacturer. And so you have a lot of these companies from around the world that are working on new varieties of plants. They put them out, they introduce them to the market. There's a chain in the distribution called the broker or distributor. So these are the people with sales reps, feet on the ground, and they're meeting with growers all over North America. And the brokers are the ones who are getting these new varieties into the greenhouses. Maybe it's a greenhouse with vegetables, maybe it's outdoor grower, if it's nursery stock or flowering shrubs, something like that. And then those growers grow out the product, grow the plants, they sell it to the retailers, and then the retailers make it available to the consumer. So I don't think that's seven. I think it's five, but that's all the processes. And that's in a very simplified version. There's a lot more complexities than what I've just described, but that is basically how a plant gets from A to Z.
Interesting. And here I always thought that some greenhouse company out there would have a bunch of seeds. They would plant the seeds, raise them up, and sell them to retail, but they're not doing that.
Well, there are some. That's one of the unique situations, or maybe it's the most common. But first of all, let me say that not everything comes from a seed. There is a lot of different ways to propagate plants. So yes, seed is one. Vegetatively propagated items, I'll just take, for example, a geranium. You've got a mother stock geranium, which is probably as big as your stove sometimes. And then they will take tiny little cuttings, max an inch long. We'll take these cuttings. A lot of them are produced offshore. And then these cuttings are shipped into North America with no soil or anything. They have no roots on them. And those are shipped to a propagation facility. So that would be like a greenhouse, huge greenhouse, who specializes in these tiny little cuttings because it takes just the right environment, the right soil, the right growth medium, the right mist, the right temperature, the right humidity in order to get those to a large enough stage, which we in the industry call a liner. If a young plant is produced from a cutting, it's called a liner. If a young plant is produced from seed, we call it a plug. And I wish you could see my fingers. They're about 2 inches apart. So you take this tiny little cutting and you grow it to a 2 or 3 inch liner or a 2 or 3 inch plug, depending on what species it is. That may go to another grower called a finishing grower. So there's two different types of growers typically. Some do it all, but for the big mass production greenhouses, they will either specialize in that plug and liner, or they will specialize in the finishing, meaning they sell direct to the retailer. The plug and liner producers sell to other growers.
Interesting. I've been dealing with plugs for a couple of decades and never knew that there was that distinction.
Yeah. And don't ask me why. It's just the way that things have evolved over the years. Vegetatively propagated items didn't really become a big thing until 25, 30 years ago, I'm going to say. And at that time, there was a lot of plug production, but then they had to differentiate between the plugs and the liners, or the ones that came from seed and the ones that came through vegetative cuttings. And my terminology right now is talking primarily about annuals and perennials. For plugs, it would be true for vegetables. And then when you get into the nursery stock or the flowering shrubs, pretty much all of them are done vegetatively propagated or tissue culture. Some perennials are produced from tissue culture. And that's another whole process that, yeah, you need to get a specialist on your podcast that would just be talking about all this breeding, because I work with breeders. I'm not a breeder myself. So what I'm giving you is the elementary version of plant breeding.
Perfect. I love that. And some things don't grow from seeds. Right now, I've got some cuttings of grapes.
Yes. Yes.
And a seedless grape doesn't have any seeds to grow from. So the way that I'm propagating them is I took cuttings and stuck them in some soil with some rooting hormone, and we're off to the races. We'll see what happens.
That's a very good example, because that's like these little 1-inch cuttings of a geranium. That's how they would be propagated as well. So good example.
So there's all these steps. And like I said, I was just under the assumption that somebody was buying seeds and planting them and selling the plant. And so why so many steps?
I think it has to do with specialization. One person or one company really can't do everything along the whole chain of distribution. So if they're specializing in breeding perennials, or they're specializing in growing plugs of tomatoes and peppers for resale, it's all about efficiency and the different business models. A breeder is research and development. A broker is sales, finance, lending, I guess the credit, you would say, because you're selling and you're selling on terms. And then the grower is just another whole business model. Very risky business model, because it's all weather dependent if they're growing outside. But believe it or not, even if they're growing indoors, it's weather dependent because of the lighting. And then for the customers, for the retailers, we all know that's very weather dependent. If you have a bad Mother's Day in Chicago, your spring is going to hurt. But if you have a fabulous Saturday, Sunday over Mother's Day weekend, your spring is going to be fabulous, because you're going to sell out your plants.
Yeah. Wow. What, interesting.
And here's another thing to think about with the horticulture industry, with the gardening industry. We're not creating metal or plastic widgets that sit on a shelf and they're good from year to year to year, right?
Right.
So we have very perishable products. And one of the things that just amazes me is how the breeders and the brokers and the growers all work on a weekly calendar. They're like, oh, that'll ship week 13, and week 52, we'll take an order, and week two is when we're going to take all these cuttings. It is all very precise, very scientific. It's based on number of weeks to maturity, number of weeks to rooting, number of weeks to transplant. So those three first segments of the distribution, the breeder, the broker, and the grower, really have to have a finely refined calendar and schedule for doing everything. And oh my goodness, if a certain shipping company messes up or doesn't ship, it can really cause a lot of harm and death among plants. They just can't survive in a box more than maybe 2 days.
Wow. That kind of reminds me of my time in the nursery industry in the mid-aughts, that 2003-04 timeframe. And I do recall, you know, they were having me place orders in advance at specific times. There was a very specific calendar around that.
Right. And that's also availability. So for example, let's say weather causes a problem or watering system causes a problem. And let's say that all the orange marigold plugs died. because of some error like that. Then at the retail for that local area, because all this is grown fairly locally, let's say that I was wanting to plant all orange this fall for whatever reason, and I went to my local retailer and they're like, we don't have the orange marigolds. It's because somewhere along that distribution chain, something happened. There may have been a crop shortage on seed. There might have been some sort of human or mechanical issue at the greenhouse. So gardening is very interesting in what all can go wrong, but what all can go really right. So you look around at your garden or anybody else's garden, just thank your lucky stars that they made it, because so much can go wrong. But like I say, so much can go right.
Yeah. Wow. And you work with a lot of breeders to showcase their varieties, don't you?
Exactly. Yes. There's two organizations here, All America Selections and National Garden Bureau. So All America Selections is the trialing. We talked about that during our last podcast. But National Garden Bureau, we act as like a mini marketing or PR firm for these companies. So we do things like we have a new plant showcase. So in fact, we're working on it right now. We're getting all the new varieties in for 2025 from the breeders. And that will launch on our website at the end of this year. We have webinars about new plants, which actually is the number one webinar as far as attendance and later for watch views on YouTube, is the new plant showcase every spring that I usually do in January. So yeah, and then we go out to the California Spring Trials every March. In fact, we're starting to manage that event. And that's where about 20 some breeders are showcasing their annuals and perennials primarily. There's some vegetables out there and a few woody ornamentals, but yeah, that's a fun event. It's not open to the public, but what on our social media stuff that we see out there, we take a lot of videos when we're out there at CAST. But yeah, that's how we work with our breeder members and promote their new varieties.
Excellent. And I know we've had multiple conversations in the past, and I know you're very passionate about this. Why is what you're doing so important?
So I'm going to say the number one reason is because the breeders are working on products that will be more successful in your garden. For example, there's different races of diseases that develop. You may think, oh, I've conquered this early season mildew or late season blight or something like that. And then what happens? It morphs, it evolves, because that disease wants to survive. Let's say you have a disease-resistant tomato. This late blight is going to say, oh, okay, I'm going to morph and change myself so that I can survive on this tomato. So then that tomato breeder has to say, oh, we have a new race of late blight. Okay, we're now going to breed this tomato to be resistant to that new strain of late blight. So all in all, that is one of the main things that the breeders are working on, because we don't want these plants to go away. We want them to survive, but you have to adapt. It's in the medical field. You're continuing to come out with new antibiotics to treat this and that. And that's what the plant breeders are doing, is to make it easier for you to grow things that are going to continue to grow and not die. And then secondarily, they're making them prettier or better, new colors of impatiens, or I see gladiolas on the back of your screen, new colors of gladiolas, a unique tomato, a better tasting tomato, a larger tomato, a smaller tomato, whatever it might be. So first and foremost, they want these plants to thrive and survive. Secondarily, they want them attractive or taste good.
Cool. And I recently saw a semi truck with the name of a plant breeding company on it, and I looked them up, and they might have been a wholesaler. I don't know exactly what kind of business they were, but I looked them up online. And one of the surprising things for me, given where I come from, is I'm growing food. So my first thought was, well, companies like this are going to be mostly growing food bearing plants. But what I noticed was that 90% of what they were raising wasn't food. It wasn't edibles. It was perennials and trees and that stuff that don't make food. So can you speak to that?
It's funny you say that, because I started doing this in 2009, which was right after that 2008 recession. And anytime that there's a recession, we see the gardening public increase the amount of vegetables that they're growing. That's great. It happened during COVID, right?
Yep.
But you cannot forget to also grow the flowers, the blooming plants, because the blooming plants attract the pollinators. The pollinators will pollinate your food. What are the stats? I think it's 33%, or am I way off? Maybe it's a lot more than that, of our food needs pollinators in order to produce food, right?
Yeah, a lot more than that.
A lot more than that. So is it more like 75%?
Probably.
Okay.
Not coming up with it, but
that makes my point even more so, is don't convert 100% of your garden to edibles, because you need the ornamentals there to attract the pollinators. And an ornamental can be an annual or a perennial or a flowering shrub or a flowering tree. They all will attract the pollinators that you need in order to get your squash and peppers, et cetera.
Perfect. And how can an average homeowner learn about these new varieties?
The easiest way, if you want just one location, is to come to our website, which is National Garden Bureau. So it's ngb.org. And right at the top, you're going to see something that says new plants. Right now, if you go on there, you'll see the 2024 and 2023 new plants, but we will launch the 2025 new varieties toward the end of this year. So in perfect time for you to plan your garden for next year, to look for seed sources, to look for plants. Yeah, you'll see them there.
Cool. So in episode 763, we talked about All America Selections. And today I want you to tell us a little bit more about National Garden Bureau. What is it and how did it come to be and why?
Okay. So this is a cool story and I love telling this. So first of all, I'm in Chicago and this office has been in Chicago for most of its existence. We are 104 years old this year. I know,
what?
Right? It's just, we're the best kept secret around, which I wish we weren't a kept secret. So I'm trying to tell more people about it. But here's the deal. National Garden Bureau was founded in 1920, which, if you look at your history, that's right in between the two world wars.
Yep.
So our founder, his name was Mr. James Burdett, and he was a journalist, but he happened to also work for a seed company. I do not have the exact name of the seed company. I'm not sure it even exists anymore, but it was here in Chicago. And so during World War I, he got involved with the Victory Gardens, which was not near as big in World War I as it was in World War II. But he was involved. He was called to Washington, D.C. to help roll them out. Then thankfully, one World War ended. He saw a need while he was working for the seed company to educate what at that time was called the backyard gardener, because I guess they thought you only could grow food in your backyard, whatever.
Right.
You know, now we say grow it everywhere, grow it front, back.
Yes.
Exactly. And so he saw this need to educate the home gardener. And so he started National Garden Bureau, and with two purposes. One was to educate and one was to inspire. And so that's the format that we started with in 1920, keeping in mind a lot of the new hybridizing of new varieties was also really coming to be during that time, which AAS and NGB were founded within 12 years of each other, ironically, in two different states by two different gentlemen. We're now all run by the same organization. So the new hybridizing was coming about. That's why the AAS trials came to be, so we could test some of these new varieties. But also with National Garden Bureau, as part of the education and inspiration, Mr. Burdett said, we're going to have members and we're going to highlight and showcase their new varieties in a number of ways, which the new plants we just talked about. And then we also have a program called the Year Of. So every year we name an annual, an edible, a bulb, a house plant, a flowering shrub, and a perennial. I think that was six. And we do this education. We do a good fact sheet. We come up with little trivia points. We feature a lot of varieties. And that too can be found on our website. So that's why he founded the organization. And then he went on, I have it on my shelf in my office. He wrote the original Victory Garden manual, which, yes, I have it. I'll have to send you a photo of it. It's so cool. When I started working here, I found it on, I think, eBay. It has a price of 5 cents, one nickel on the cover. In 2010, I ended up paying, I think, $45 for it. But I think I got the last one in existence, at least one that anybody wants to sell.
I'm going to find one.
Okay, good luck. Let me know if you find it. Yes. So moving forward in time, in, when was COVID? Gosh, I've already forgotten now. 2020? Was that when COVID came?
Yes, 2020 was the COVID year. Yeah.
Thank you. Gail and I in our office in that March, when we found out we were going to have this lockdown and work from home and everything, we were saying, how are we going to do this? We need some blogs. How are we going to brainstorm? How are we going to write these? And I looked at my bookshelf and I saw the Victory Garden manual. And I said, Gail, it's time for another Victory Garden push. And we were not the first ones. There were a lot of people doing it at the same time. We were calling it Victory Garden 2.0. There were other people calling it the same thing, which is awesome. It just tells you we were all on the same page of, let's grow our own food. Let's get outdoors. Let's not let COVID and this isolation get to us. Let's work in our gardens. So that kind of gives you the history of how this organization was started and then how we paid tribute to his book, The Victory Garden Manual.
Wow. Well, interesting. You were doing that in Phoenix. My team and I, in March of 2020, put together our Victory Garden series of classes. Our goal was to give a class a day for 90 days. And it was free. We just broadcasted them on our YouTube channel and went for it. And that was right around the same time you were doing your Victory Garden stuff.
That is so cool. And we didn't even know each other then. We hadn't been introduced yet, but we were definitely working on the same things. Like-minded individuals.
Right. There you go. How does one interact as a homeowner with National Garden Bureau?
Just come to our website, follow us on social media, ask questions. You can comment on our blogs. You can share anything that's on there. And here's the main thing is get inspired. So I have another funny story for you. I didn't think I was a storyteller, but you're bringing out some stories today.
Nice. And
this is also about Gail. She'd probably kill me if she knew that I was talking about her like this. But so every year, the 6 year of crops, we decide on which crops, which genera we're focusing on about 2 years prior. Uh-huh. So we ask our members to write these fact sheets that give historical information. This is a native to Asia and it was brought to North America in 1830, whatever the case is. So we're reading these and she and I have both been gardening for a long time, probably all of our lives. Mm-hmm. And it never fails. We read these year of fact sheets and we're reading it to edit it and make sure that everything is okay. We jump up, we walk into the other office and it's, did you know this about squash? I didn't know that about squash. I have to plant this kind of squash this year. And then we look at each other and we just laugh because we're like, okay, I think we just got inspired by this fact sheet.
Yeah. That's the thing about gardening. I've been growing food since the mid-1970s, and I'm always learning something new.
Exactly. Yes. And I'm very proud to say that because of our members and who they are, a lot of these breeding companies and growers, we're always learning new things. So that's what we try to put in our blogs. That's what we're putting on our social media posts. We have a huge YouTube channel now. We have two YouTube channels. Both of them, each of them has 10,000 followers, which for us is really good. It's not
that's
influencer level, like 100,000, but it's really good for a nonprofit doing what we're doing.
Yeah. Wow. Thanks for doing that.
It's our pleasure.
And the website is?
ngb.org. So it's nationalgardenbureau.org.
Perfect. So I'm going to shift on you. And as a returning guest, I always like to ask about a vivid childhood memory associated with food. Because I know for me, I have several of those that kind of solidified who I am today.
Okay. This is just a fond memory. So let me preface it by saying I don't like really hot weather. If it's over 85, I melt and I get grumpy. Secondly, as you mentioned, I grew up in Missouri. I grew up on a family farm. We had like 500 acres and my dad farmed the corn, wheat, soybeans, et cetera. My mom was a huge gardener. So there was a good chunk of our 60 acres that we lived on that was her garden. But there was one beautiful August day. The carrots were ready. It must have been earlier than August because I think peas. So maybe these are two separate memories, but they're both the same. My grandfather had planted a maple tree just outside of our back door, and it had grown to a point where it provided beautiful shade. And my mom knew I was grumpy. So here you go, Diane, you sit here to shell these peas and you sit here to scrape these carrots, because of course she canned hundreds and hundreds of jars every year of the tomatoes and the green beans and the peas and the carrots. That's when I learned how much fun it was to shell peas and hear them go ping, ping, ping into the metal pan. And yeah. I also learned how to do the double scrape on the carrot. You don't just do one way, you do back and forth, and it's much faster. And the weather was just perfect. Sitting under that maple tree, it wasn't too hot. And they just kept bringing me more and more carrots. And here I was going through all the carrots and making them or prepping them so that she could can them.
Nice. I hear you on the ping ping. I actually grow, for many years in Phoenix, I've grown a rear red cowpea. And yeah. one of my favorite things to do with them is I harvest them and let them dry and shuck them while I'm watching a movie.
So you get the ping, ping, ping as background noise for your movie.
Exactly. So thank you for that. And what new piece of advice do you have for our listeners?
Try something new. I think there are so many new plants that are coming out, or old plants that you've never tried, a different genera that maybe it's a cowpea. Okay, yeah. I've grown snow peas or whatever, but maybe I've never grown a cowpea. Try something new. That's what's so fun. You never know when it becomes yours or your family's new favorite food, or it'll become the one that the neighbors stop by when they're walking the dog and go, wow, that is an amazing purple lily or whatever it is. It gives you pleasure, pride, sense of satisfaction.
When there's so many opportunities, different ones out there. We were at the North Carolina Arboretum just yesterday, and we saw some green flowers that we'd never seen before, a green color. And it's like, wow, the diversity is just amazing in nature.
I totally agree. And you brought up something that I guess another piece of advice is visit your local public gardens, botanical gardens. We work with about 200 of them to send the AAS winners out to every year. Mm-hmm. So when you're visiting these gardens, you may be seeing some of these new varieties that are just now hitting the market or may not hit the market until next year, because sometimes they get a little advanced preview. That's my second piece of advice. Visit a public garden.
Nice, 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 nice. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Diane.
Thank you for having me. It's a delight. The time just flies by when we're chatting.
Absolutely. I love having you. And how can our listeners get a hold of you?
Go onto our website, ngb.org, and comment, follow. If you need to email us, there's an email information and a form at the bottom of the page.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you. And you can find show notes from today's podcast at urbanfarm.org/NGB.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Urban Farm Podcast. Remember to listen for tips, advice, and resources to help you on your journey with urban farming. You can find us on the web at urbanfarm.org, or send us an email to podcast@urbanfarm.org. In the words of Vincent Van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things brought together. Be encouraged that with each lesson learned and skill developed, you are one step closer in the direction of your dreams.